So the first bullet point question for us is, thing to consider is the prerequisites for Australian banks to start offering clearing services. Will this bring structural change to Australia's clearing regime? Well, I guess the second part of that question presupposes that the first part's yes. So I might just throw to Mark briefly to talk about how regulators think of the provision of financial services in the context of OTC clearing.
Sure. Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here today and very well-attended conference. So as most around the room will know, the government is now moving forward with the implementation of a central clearing mandate for trades between internationally active dealers in interest rate derivatives in Australian dollars, US dollars, Japanese yen, British pound, and euro. And the choice, the decision to restrict the proposed mandate to internationally active dealers really reflects some work that the regulators did in late 2013, early 2014, where we did quite an extensive survey of non-dealers' use of OTC derivatives, and there we were really trying to establish what the public policy case for extending a clearing mandate to that segment would actually be. One of the important aspects that we were looking at there was non-dealer readiness for clearing and also non-dealer access to appropriate clearing arrangements. What I mean by access to appropriate clearing arrangements, what do I mean by that? Well, really, we were thinking about a number of dimensions there. First of all, what was the choice and availability of client clearing services at licensed CCPs? What was the design of those arrangements, for instance, in relation to matters such as segregation, account segregation, and portability? And also, what was the nature of access to clearing agency services? So what were the arrangements whereby a non-dealer could become an indirect participant of these CCPs? What were the nature of the clearing services offered by clearing agents in that market? And what was their sufficient choice and availability of those? What were the contractual terms on which such services would be provided? A lot's changing in this space. At that particular time, we really found that non-dealers had not taken steps to ensure their readiness and to access the arrangements that were already in place there. And also, we found that the size and the profile of non-dealer activity in interest rate derivatives was very, very different to that of the dealers. Much less activity, very, very few large non-dealers, and quite a long tail of smaller non-dealers in that particular segment. The primary motivation for many of these was hedging activity. And as a result, they were quite directional in their OTC exposures, and also potentially quite liquidity constrained, which would mean that they could face quite some difficulties in accessing the relevant liquidity to be able to meet CCP margin requirements, for instance. Overall, therefore, the conclusion was that the systemic risk reduction benefit of extending the mandate to non-dealers might be quite limited. There could be unintended consequences in terms of access to liquidity, potential liquidity constraints for non-dealers, and there remain questions over the breadth, choice, availability of clearing services, either from clearing agents or at that particular time, the CCPs themselves. So, nevertheless, we did feel that commercial incentives might emerge over time, and we were quite content to let those commercial incentives ultimately dictate the pace at which non-dealers accessed clearing for their OTC derivatives activity.
Yeah, I think you've pointed to perhaps a third part, which is the regulator view about A, appropriateness of offering, and B, desire to make sure that people who want clearing can get into it. So, Mark, what are you doing to help the altruistic Australian banks provide this tremendous service to their customers?
I knew you'd pick up on that one, Andrew. That's why I threw it out there.
Look, I might just start off by saying that the evolution that John has just described is one that we're very, very alive to, and that that evolution of the pool of providers of clearing agency services shrinking, and even those that continue to provide those services perhaps being more alive themselves to how each and every client that they provide services for is using up their capital and their collateral. And this is part of a broader trend of banking institutions looking that much more closely at internal transfer pricing within their institutions, and therefore more looking more carefully at how each individual business unit can stand on its own two feet and can justify the capital and collateral allocation that it has. And I think this has all really been very much in our minds in this discussion around non-dealer clearing. Ultimately, this does have very real implications for the choice and availability of clearing services. And there are three dimensions there. It's the mere availability, the access to clearing. It's the market structure of clearing agency services. Ultimately, if you do mandate central clearing, you potentially add to the scale of exposures to that that CCPs have to that very, very concentrated set of large clearing agents. And it also starts to get you thinking about whether CCPs may ultimately have to be thinking about alternative access models other than the existing clearing agent or FCM client relationship. Are there models that might be considered where non-dealers can get direct access via some type of special clearing membership, but somehow allows them to take advantage of clearing agents' operational capacity without using up so much of their capital allocation? And perhaps we can have a bit of a discussion about that on the panel. But more generally, what are we doing in terms of access for those that want it and those that have the commercial incentive to get in there? Well, one important aspect of this is how we supervise the CCP's client clearing arrangements. There is a standard within our financial stability standards that looks at segregation and portability and client clearing arrangements more generally. There's also a standard around tiering, which looks at the relationship between direct and indirect participants. In our general supervision of the CCPs, alongside our colleagues at ASIC, we do look very, very carefully at those models and ensure that they comply with those standards. and that is being able to do so in a way that is observing the requirements under those standards is a prerequisite for being able to provide those services. And we've been through that process with both LCH and ASX, who are represented on the panel today. Thank you.
So I think we've covered a lot of the areas, Mark, you know, if you can summarise where you feel that the regulator is in terms of that balance between access and stability.
Yeah, look, it's a very live debate in many respects. CCPs have always been systemically important, but with the G20 commitments and the transition to clearing in the OTC derivatives market, that's clearly accentuated and heightened that systemic importance, and that has led to a reinvigoration, if you like, of the debate in the international standard-setting community around what is the what is the right balance to strike? Where is the what are the minimum standards that should be applied to ensure that CCPs are indeed this undoubted provide this undoubted guarantee in terms of their management of counterparty credit risks. And that debate led in the first instance in 2012 to the Principles for Financial Market Infrastructures that CPMI, the Committee on Payments and Market Infrastructures, and IOSCO published, and that has now been implemented internationally. And in Australia, the bank's financial stability standards essentially embody all of the stability-related principles there. And these do cover all of the aspects that that have already been discussed on the panel. One of the new requirements that came out of the Principles for Financial Market Infrastructures was the requirement around recovery planning to ensure that the CCP could rapidly return itself to viability in the face of a very extreme shock. And this, what we're talking about here is a shock that that would be multiple participant defaults in beyond extreme but plausible circumstances. And CPMI OSCO last year set out a number of guidelines for recovery planning at CCPs that really set out a bit of a toolkit, a menu of options around dealing with non-pre-funded losses, uncovered liquidity shortfalls, how to restore the CCP to a match book in those extreme circumstances, how to address non-default losses, and then how to replenish those pre-funded resources. And those guidelines, as I say, set out a menu of tools that could be applied there, but also set out the desirable characteristics of those tools around comprehensiveness, effectiveness, creating the right incentives, minimising spillovers. And the CCPs represented on this panel have worked through their own recovery plans, and they are being assessed in accordance with these guidelines. But as Mark has said, there's another backstop to that, and that's resolution arrangements. And that's something that we've been thinking about very, very closely in the regulatory community here in Australia, but also internationally. And in Australia, the government consulted on a special resolution regime for FMIs earlier this year and is now working through the responses to that consultation and refining those proposals. But the general sense is that if a CCP does indeed have a comprehensive and effective recovery plan, you should never, ever get to the point at which resolution would be necessary. But nevertheless, it is very important to have that backstop, again, with the ultimate objective being financial stability and continuity of these critical services to the market. So this is very much, as I say, a live debate both domestically and internationally. Some around the room may have heard about the FSB-led International CCP Work Plan, which is really taking another look off a few years after the Principles for Financial Market Infrastructure have been established and put into place. to see whether there are some refinements necessary in the critical areas of CCP financial risk management. And that work plan is looking at all aspects, really. Stress testing, margin models, loss-absorbing capacity, recovery arrangements, and indeed resolution as well, taking into account some of the looking, for instance, at some of the issues that Mark has mentioned around how to best coordinate resolution on a cross-border basis, should that ever be necessary.
So it is interesting that the principles do allow for differences that are based on the business model of the CCP and are not effectively dictatorial outside a principles base. So that means we've got two other topics that we advertised we were going to talk about here. Topic number one was compression. I think the answer to the question is yes, it's good. The next question is reporting. And we are in the midst of getting on with reporting. Mark, again, sorry to throw to you, but we do have a question and answer, which is what's the single-sided reporting, how would it be carried out, and what is the regulator group looking for?
So I think here this is really very much the domain of my colleagues at ASIC, but just in a very at a very high level, the intention here, and the government recently consulted on a single-sided reporting regime, whereby institutions that in the context of the regulation known as Phase 3B entities that have OTC derivatives outstanding of less than $5 billion would be able to, would have relief from the trade reporting requirement as long as the counterparty with which they were trading was subject to the reporting requirements, and therefore that the trade into which they'd executed would actually be reported. And this relief, as I say, has been consulted on. The government is currently considering the responses to the consultation there. In the absence of of such relief, I think the reporting requirement for Phase 3B entities would kick in the middle of October, and to that extent, the government is looking to confirm this position over the coming couple of months. That's probably all I need really say about that.